Hey, Bill and Gunn, welcome to Black Lord Tribal Edition. Murray here with you today. And I hope you're doing well wherever you are listening to this program. And we've got an interesting lineup today of the usual suspects. Ganyara and Nyurlumbumi is not here at the moment. I think he's hunting and fishing at the moment, so that's good on him. But later on in the program, we'll have part two of the documentary or series of how Canada is looking to implement UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So that'll be interesting. It is a year and a bit old, but it has some valuable information for those people who are interested in Indigenous rights and where Indigenous rights belong and who can be the beneficiary of those things. So anyway, we're going to be looking at an article posted online. Indigenous X is one of those, flagship or leaders in online Indigenous content. One of the very first, many years ago, more than 10 years ago now, they were the voice to go to, I guess, on platforms like Twitter and Facebook. And there's an interesting article that was written about First Nations foreign policy, a fundamental contradiction. This is the article. I might read a little bit and then get some special comments from the our panelists today. This is an interesting issue only because the federal election is on and Australia is talking about whether they're going to do this and the other and what kind of direction they're going to take. But one of the interesting things is whether if Peter Dutton gets in, whether the Indigenous ambassador that's currently held by Justin Muhammad will continue or not. So I think they've made all those decisions already, but let's have a look at it. So Samantha Gilmore is the writer, and she says Australia's proposed First Nations foreign policy claims to centre Indigenous perspectives, yet its settler colonial foundations make this impossible. Very good observation. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations practiced diplomacy long before the settler colony of Australia, was established. Yet the systemic framework of settler colonialism has rendered genuine First Nations foreign policy impossible within the settler state structures. Today, despite claims of incorporating First Nations perspectives into foreign policy, Australia's approach appears more about optics than genuine transformation. The Australian Labor Party's 2023 proposal for a constitutional advisory committee, The Voice, was proposed as part of a broader government agenda to incorporate First Nations values into governance. However, the Australian public rejection of the Voice referendum underscores an incapacity for the settler state and its society to embrace First Nations perspectives. Authentically, that is. As a settler colonial state, Australia's institutions are designed to prioritise settler interests. For example, while Australia claims to value First Nations custodianship, it continues to approve mining projects that desecrate country that mob have nourished for millennia. Similarly, while First Nations diplomatic principles emphasise reciprocal and just relations, Australia's global alliances with the US and Israel, hello Langley, reflect its prioritisation of settler interests over global Indigenous solidarity. This makes true support of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander agency inherently incompatible within the existing colonial framework. So it goes on. It's a very, very good article. It's going on for a very long time there. You can have a really good read and dive deep into that. But we sort of already knew that, and that's why the Yidinji Nation had to establish its own foreign affairs mechanism, or to enter into international relations, which is one of those Montevideo Convention attributes of statehood. Ganyara, even blind Freddie can see that diplomacy inside of Australia can only promote Australian values, and those are values aren't Yidinji's.
It sounds very much like the author has been listening to BBM, to be quite honest, you know, because we've been putting this out for years, that there is two worlds, there is coexisting sovereignty. We knew there was. They know there is. So how can they have an Indigenous ambassador when really it should be going through the Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, you know, the Australian one, that is. They should be talking through that, not through some independent ambassador that's lower down the ladder than the Minister for Foreign Affairs, because, you know what, we're foreign. We are alien to Australia. We're foreign to the Commonwealth of Australia. And what the author does say there is quite correct. It is a colonial settlement. No ifs and no buts about that. It's a manifestation of colonialism, which goes against the grain, which goes against the international norm. So it's one of those things where they're saying the right thing, but they're not seeing the whole and the full picture of stuff. So in saying that, the Commonwealth of Australia, I have to ask all the citizens, can someone take me to the Commonwealth of Australia, the real, where you can go and see it, smell it and touch it? That Commonwealth of Australia, you know, not the paper one, not the paper that hangs on the wall, not the artificial construct in the science of law, but the real Commonwealth of Australia, because that's where I need to see, because I don't think there is one. We have a geographical Australia, the land out there that all the tribes have their territory upon, and if the tribes have their territory upon that, by the way, which is what Uluru's statement said, not us, we know where our territory is, but Uluru's statement came out and said that the first sovereign nations are the Aboriginal people, and those first sovereign nations own their land and territory pursuant to their laws and customs, not the laws and customs of Australia. So the settler state has just moved into our house and they've sat on our lounge chair for a while. Then all of a sudden they took over our breakfast table. Then they took over the kitchen. And then they took over the bedroom. And then they just took over everything. But they're still only a settler state. They don't have any true connection to country. This is what I'm saying to most people. The sovereignty that coexists, the sovereignty that allows a nation to exist, is has always been here, but theirs does not have the right to be here.
Yeah, so it sounds like a Goldilocks story when you're telling that position. But, Yeryl, I'm very, very clear that obviously the identities of the various nations that, and I know you talk about often your relationships and friendships from when you went to school, that you knew about these different tribal groups and cultural groups from your you kicking around in the play school and that.
Well, you know, that's sort of a major point there, that's where I learned it. It wasn't from my education. It certainly wasn't shared through any formal structure that's the case, that this is the truth that of the land that I was living on. So it had to come from first-hand experience of the traditional owners of all the lands of this whole continent. And I hear so often, I'm glad that Gagnari sort of put that forward legally, that so often we talk about Australia. And for me, you know, prior to being a part of Yidinji, if you heard Australia, you identified that sort of to mean you or yourself or the land you're on. And that's exactly right. It is not. Australia is not the traditional lands. It is something that has been constructed legally. And once again, that's what we carry around in our pockets. You know, if I'm driving a car on Queensland roads, I've got a Queensland license and on there is my identification. But that is not the primal, that's not the first identification. There is a one that precedes that.
Yes, and that's what John the Baptist said. There's one before me that is preferred before me. He was here from the very beginning, and that's Yidinji, by the way. He was talking about Jesus Christ at that time. However, in this case, you can carry multiple identities. I certainly don't. And that's the difference. I mean, if I have an Australian ID, my name was Lena, let's say, obviously I'm not that person. But very clearly, I think that message is going through to the other side. Anyway, I was coming back to this foreign diplomacy stuff. Through its foreign ministry, that is Yidinji's, the whole world now is starting to learn about the Yidinji way of life. If it's through Australia, it's not. And look, I don't have everyone, you know, we know that Australia is there. And people have imagined that over the years. But the whole point is that they're not pushing the Yidinji agenda or the interests of the Yidinji nation at that level that we are actually happy with, Gagnara, and only we can do that.
Why do they have to have a special ambassador for an Indigenous Australian? Why don't they have a special ambassador for the British Australians? Why don't they have a special ambassador for the American Australians? Why don't they have a special ambassador for the Chinese Australians? They can't. They won't. And that's the same as the Aboriginal people. What they are is mixing up the heritage. They're actually being racist by doing that. And look, I agree with Dutton. over this, that they've got to abolish that position. There is no position in there for a special group of Australian citizens. And by the way, all Australian citizens are created equal. And yes, Pauline Hanson is an Indigenous Australian. I love to see, keep saying that. So is Bob Catter. They are Indigenous Australians just as much as the Pat Dodsons and all those sort of the world. You know, they're all Indigenous Australians. All Australians are created subject and pursuant to the Australian Constitution. Ultimately, that's the source document for all law and authority of the Commonwealth of Australia and the states. So anyone created within Australia, the Commonwealth of Australia that is created pursuant to that document, and they are all Indigenous Australians. So why would you have a special position, a special office for the Ambassador for Indigenous Australians? You shouldn't. There should be no office like that. And by the way, the Indigenous Australians, if you want to call them that, the Aboriginal people who are using an Australian identity, make up only 3% of the polity, of the Commonwealth of Australia, of the population of Australia. They make up 3%. Why can 3% have a special voice, have a special ambassador, have a special treaty, when in reality they are just as much Australian as the British Australians and the American Australians and the Chinese Australians? They're all one and the same thing. Just of the human that uses them, though, is of a different heritage. And this is the important part, that we can't mix humans with persons.
Yeah, and I think it's very, very clear that, let's say you're using Facebook, you're going to have some sort of account with Facebook to use it, but anything you put on there belongs to Facebook. Photos, your posts, you have to use Facebook mechanisms to buy online and all that kind of stuff. Australia's the same. You can't play the game unless you're using an Australian identity. Most Yidinji nationals have dual identities. I don't know what their other identity is. That's none of my business. But it's very clear that you're going to have a chip or a little... And when you're playing the Monopoly board, you need a token to play that, and you get the benefits of it. You can get $200 when you go past go. You can go to jail. You can buy property and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, the board game, you don't own it. You're just using it. Sovereignty is about owning the whole lot, and the Yidinji nation sees value and knows the value of things and persons. So very clearly, once again, those aspirations and intentions aren't going to be voiced through the Australian government because it is a contradiction, as that article clearly outlines.
Look, people have got to understand citizenship is membership. It's contract law to allow a human to participate in the life of the Commonwealth of Australia. That's all it is. There's nothing more, nothing less. So it allows the human, it's not the human, but it allows you to play the game. It's your token in the game. Instead of calling it Monopoly, we call it the Commonwealth of Australia. So you have your token, which is your identity that's created pursuant to Australian legislation or state legislation, which is subject to the Constitution, but it's still Australian no matter what. The identity is Australian. And through that identity, you can then participate in the game, the life of the state. And just think about this. Now, you're using that identity that they create, so it's really their identity. And you're going out to buy a car with their money, with their identity. Who does the car really belong to? You know, what is bought by the slave is owned by the master. And really, that car you bought, you thought you bought for yourself, for the human, is not. It belongs to the state. It belongs to the Commonwealth of Australia or the state of Queensland or whatever it is. So you're using your hard-earned effort to go out and buy assets for the Commonwealth of Australia or the state of Queensland. Don't forget that. It's not your car. And this is how police can take a car off a Queensland driver when they're doing the wrong thing. You know, they can come in and seize the asset that belongs to them. You've only got a right to use it while you're being good. But that doesn't... Don't confuse that with the sovereignty of the Indigenous nations. The Indigenous nations, as Uluru said, is the sovereignty is equal to, if not better than, that of the Crown, and it coexists with the Crown. What it does say in Uluru, though, is that those first Aboriginal nations are the owners. They're everything. They own the territory. They own everything on their territory, and they control all persons and things. There's an old maxim of law at that. If it's your territory, you control everything on it. Where's the territory of the Commonwealth of Australia? We've laid claim to our territory, and no one has rebutted it. And I know there's other Aboriginal nations that are coming back to life, the Yidinji way, and they're laying claim to their territory. Justin Muhammad can't speak for and on behalf of Australia. The only one who can is Penny Wong, and she's got to negotiate with the ministers for foreign affairs and trade of those independent Aboriginal nations, the first in time ones, whose sovereignty is unceded and unextinguished, and it coexists with that of the Crown. This is what Penny's role is, not the Indigenous ambassador. The foreign affairs minister has that role, and that's the only one who can talk to our lot.
Yurlam.
Yeah, like it's interesting that Ganyara pointed out that, you know, what's bought by the slave is owned by the master. And yet, you know, the Commonwealth of Australia is built on slavery, on what it did to the people that were here before them. And I think there is a deep-seated fear that that they're going to be in their position of being the slave to the true masters of the lands itself. And, you know, what goes around comes around. And in this case, they're very fortunate that the kindness and the disposition of the first people of this country is not one of violence. So, you know, in this case, it's about coming together and moving forward, just as Yidinji is putting forward now.
Yeah, and truly, it's one of those most frustrating things is that, you write a letter to Penny Wong and you put it in a phone call over the years and not one response, not even an email. So, I mean, this is the thing now that Australians should really comprehend, that their own government is not looking potentially at the interests of itself and their citizens, because there should be some sort of settlement or strive to settle with the original owners, and currently there isn't.
The government's not telling the truth. That's more the case. The government hasn't got the fortitude to tell the truth about what the current state of play is. And they're worried about the Australians revolting. You know, it was said to me one day, I was talking to a group of Australians about the government's not telling you the truth. And they said, oh, we'll sort the problem out. We'll take the guns up and we'll shoot blackfellas and politicians. I said, that's a really intelligent position to take, isn't it? Why don't you go and talk to your politicians and say, what is the true state of play? What do I actually own when I go and buy a house or a piece of land? What is it that I own? If them mob over there own it, the Aboriginal people, as acknowledged in the Uluru Statement, if they say that this was the best constitutional lawyers, by the way, that put out the statement, not us, and they said the Aboriginal peoples are the owners. If we're the owners and Native Title Determination supports that, if we're the owners, what do the Australians buy when they go and buy a house? Remember, whatever is attached to the land is owned by the owners of the land. So quite obviously every house that's put on our territory belongs to the mob, belongs to the Yidinji mob. So the Australians should be asking, what did we buy? What did I actually buy with my hard-earned sweat? You know, I went to work and I done everything I could to buy a house for my family. And yet the house ultimately is owned by the Yidinji mob here. That's not fair, you know. So they should be asking the politicians, what is it? And I bet you the politicians don't have the fortitude, the moral fortitude to say, well, look, we're a colonial settler state. We're actually in breach of international law. And by the way, the department, the federal AG, the Attorney General, he supports the rule of law. That department supports the rule of law locally and internationally. And one of the, if you go back to one of the international norms, Resolution 1514 of 1960, every country must be decolonised. And any form or manifestation of colonialism must go quickly. Now, how long ago was that? You know, you go, oh, that was only 65 years ago, and they haven't done it here properly. They said, oh, Australia was decolonised. It was not. You know, it's the manifestation of colonialism, because we were the ones, the Indigenous nations were the ones that were colonised, not the Commonwealth of Australia. And this is the illusion that they have for all the Australians. They said, oh, the British went back. The British went back, but they left a form of colonialism here, or a manifestation of it, because we still have the English monarch now as the King of Australia. So we've got the King of the UK, same bloke, same man holds the King of the UK, King of here, King of Canada, King of New Zealand, whatever it is, same bloke, different identities. But he has got no right to be the king out here. He's got to go back to where he rightfully comes. And that means Australia should leave, or we get a power sharing arrangement in place with the local mobs, you know, with all the local owners, those who own the place, as they say in the Uluru Statement. This is what it's all about. They haven't got the fortitude to tell them that, but they give the Aboriginal people some illusionary, you know, toy telephone. That's what the voice was going to be, a toy telephone. Had no right, no veto powers, had no right to interfere with legislation that affects them. And rightly so, it's only a toy telephone because they're not the true people who Australia has to do a deal with. They're doing a deal with the Indigenous Australians, and John Howard got it right. A nation cannot treaty with itself. Of course you can't. You've got a treaty with those of equal sovereignty, and Indigenous Australians don't hold sovereignty. It resides in the Commonwealth of Australia. So there's many aspects to this, and that's just like this Indigenous ambassador. He's got no right to speak over and above what Penny Wong or the Minister for Foreign Affairs would have to say. So it should be her office and her office alone that talks to all the Aboriginal nations in their true and correct capacity, not as Indigenous Australians. That's the important part.
Yeah, and it's disappointing that, you contact the Justin Muhammad's office and no response, no emails, no phone calls, nothing. So what is he doing? What are they doing? I mean, if that's the response, then certainly it's not doing their job.
He can't exceed Penny Wong. He can't exceed the Minister for Foreign Affairs. Just like when Yurilam mentioned earlier that when he went to an Australian school, he didn't learn anything about the Aboriginal schooling or the Aboriginal stuff that that was here. They weren't allowed to. They weren't allowed to talk about that because that's our right. That's our stuff. They can only talk about Australia's stuff, their colonisation process and how they won this on the, at war in Anzac, and they built it on the sheep's back. That's what Australia's story is. It's their story, but it's not the correct one. They couldn't learn about the Aboriginal story because that belonged to Yidinji here. Australia had no right, especially Queensland Education had no right to talk about our stuff without asking us. They could have said to us, okay, look, can we teach some of your stuff in our schools?
Yeah.
And we would have rightfully said so.
They had no right to teach it, but they got the right to take the minerals and all these other things.
Have they?
No, they haven't. So this is the whole point. So you can't partition this and not talk to Yidinji, but you steal Yidinji's stuff. So this is a really the most frustrating part of it. And Justin, if you're listening, Penny, if you're listening, you're not doing your job. And I'm sorry to say that, but, we've been here for more than 10 years now. This office has been here operating for the last 10 years at least. And, it's easier for us to talk to other foreign nations, that is in the UN system, like the big ones, without mentioning names. But, I think that speaks volumes.
Look, it's their choice to recognise or not recognise us. It's their choice. But it's also our choice or our right to go forward and talk to those who will talk to us, be it whatever nation it is around the world, those who may offer the best deal. Now, Australia is in a very vulnerable position right at present. They got the whole world scared that the Chinese are coming. The Chinese are going to take over. Fear China, fear China, fear China. Be very careful of what you're putting out there because that's giving the oppressed people the belief that they may have to side with those Chinese that are coming in. It's not our position at this stage. Our position is to try and build Australia up, try and support Australia, try and get Australia in place properly so that no one can come between us and them. But if they leave this wide open, if they leave this big gap in the wall for another nation to come in, they will come in because there's a lot of mineral resources at stake. Australia has no right to take them. They've made that very clear. Actually, Australia must pay for all that has been taken. If you read the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, Article 28, it says, give them back all their stuff, all the stuff they've been dispossessed of, or pay for the lot. Now, Australia can't afford to pay us, let alone pay the next mob. So this is what I'm saying. Australia has left itself wide open for other nations that are not so Australia-friendly to come in and step in on the country, which is really sad to say. I'd like to be able to say we've done the right thing for Australia by offering this to Australia, by getting them in and getting a treaty in place where no one else can step in and destroy it.
You're listening to Black World Tribal Edition right across the planet today, and we've got Yurilam and Ganyara in the office, the studio here. Ganyara, I mean, there's this fear that China's taken over, but it's the Australian government that's pro-China, Dan Andrews in Victoria in recent times. The Darwin port was sold or a 99-year lease to the Chinese. But, you mentioned the Chinese development in the Torres Straits, and, of course, everyone goes back to the Brisbane line and it's all this fear-mongering again. So at the same time, they are taking advantage of it, and they're the ones running the agenda. Now, that is the Commonwealth of Australia. And I just have to say that it's very interesting that they'll make probably the scapegoat the indigenous nations for doing businesses with China and Brazil and Russia and everyone else, but at the same time they're doing deals up front now that add life to these relationships. And it's not so surprising that China is Australia's largest trading partner, yet there's all this fear-mongering about Indigenous peoples dealing direct with China.
I think what they're living in fear of is losing sovereignty, losing control of the country, losing control of himself. Not that they ever had it over the Aboriginal people. The only way they could have control of the Aboriginal people was to convince them that they had to be Indigenous Australians, that they had to come in from the dark side, come into the white side. Now, you know, 3% in a population, you know, 3% is so small and minuscule, you got no say in there. 3%, you got nothing. Understand what UNDRIP says, the UN Declaration. It says you can go back and self-govern, self-determine. You can take part in the life of the state if you want. You can't be forced to assimilate. You can do whatever you got to do yourself domestically. It's the international stuff that we'd rather prefer that Australia be, that Australia take charge of the defence of the country, or if Australia won't step up to the plate, that a bigger nation might step up to the plate and defend our territory from all others. Now, that was supposed to be the case down in New Zealand when the British went down there. They said, OK, we'll defend you Maoris from everyone else. Are they really defending them now, or the British left and just left it in the hands of a third-party interloper you call, you know, the New Zealand government? They got no right to be in that treaty down there, and the Maoris should be calling on Britain to come and rescue them from the New Zealanders. But I bet you they won't. I bet you they won't go down and rescue them. This is how the world has got. So that treaty is over and done with, and it goes back to the rightful owners. Just as our mobs here, who haven't ceded sovereignty, or it hadn't been extinguished, and they can't extinguish it, by the way, so they do recognise it, and they say, oh, we've chosen not to recognise you. You already have recognised us legally by the court cases that are going on, by Mabo 2, by all the native title determinations, by all this other legislation that's in place. You're choosing to recognise us. You know, even the bill for the voice referendum, they've gone very, very clearly in there, said, oh, we've got to do a deal with this other mob. Who are the other mob? Why do we have to give them a special voice in Australia? Maybe they're not in Australia. So we have to. So there's recognition all the way that can be shown in any court of law now that Australia knows exactly what's going on.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today. We'll be back after the break.
Ya yunda yalada, ngayo buri buri gari. You're listening to BBM 98.7 FM with Deline Briscoe.
Welcome back. Part two is up next with a series by Nick Leeson, who's a lawyer in North America who is a supporter and promoter of Indigenous rights. This is part two of his series on how Canada is adopting UNDRIP into its domestic space. And UNDRIP is the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Enjoy part two.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me on this second of our two-part series looking at UNDRIP and its implementation into Canadian law. We'll start this part by looking at Canada's ever-evolving position on UNDRIP. We'll then move to look at the core elements of Canada's UNDRIP implementation law, followed by a discussion of the challenges of implementing UNDRIP into Canada. Lastly, we're going to have a discussion about the ways that we can promote UNDRIP and its implementation in the things that we do and in the communities that we live. So, with that, let's begin. Canada's ever-evolving position on UNDRIP. As discussed in part one of this video together, UNDRIP rights go above and beyond existing Canadian law in terms of recognizing Indigenous rights. But to be clear, UNDRIP does not create more or better standards for international human rights for Indigenous peoples than it does for all others. What it does is it looks at human rights that are already protected under international law, and it clarifies that those rights also apply to Indigenous peoples. Even though that should be obvious and completely unnecessary, history tells us otherwise, as there is a long history in both international and Canadian law denying Indigenous peoples basic human rights that are afforded to everyone else. So UNDRIP says Indigenous peoples have the same individual human rights as everyone else on the planet. And it also does one thing more than that. The Declaration describes distinct collective or shared rights of the group that Indigenous peoples alone uniquely hold, such as the right to their culture and lands. Indigenous peoples are the only ones who have these rights because of their prior and first occupancy over their lands and territories. This makes it clear that Indigenous peoples are not a problem to be solved, a risk to be minimized, or a burden to be removed, but right holders to be respected. And that goes further than Canadian law has consistently been willing to do. And this slide helps explain some of that inconsistency by Canadian law. See, this is a timeline of how the Declaration came to be from when Indigenous peoples first wrote it all the way to the present day. And I'm sorry that it's impossible to read, but that's what 40 years of struggle will do. And that huge timeline shows how hard it was to get the world to agree that Indigenous peoples had the same basic rights as all other free people, including the basic right as the first occupants to their lands to be self-determining over their own territories. So on the far left of this timeline, you can see that even though the work on the Declaration began in the 70s and 80s, and a draft was mostly finished by 1995, it wasn't actually approved by the United Nations until 2007. And that was even following significant concessions and compromises being made, including the introduction of Article 46, or the last article. Article 46 was the result of a significant back and forth in order to get consensus, or at least near consensus, support of the world's nations for the Declaration. Article 46 was contentious, specifically subsection 2, but the entire article wasn't a part of the consensus that was drafted by Indigenous peoples. Instead, it was added by nation states. Essentially, Article 46 acts as a limitations clause to the rights under the Declaration. In this way, it's similar to how the notwithstanding clause limits charter rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it does this by expressly contemplating that qualifications to UNDRIP rights will be necessary where they intersect or potentially conflict with other rights or requirements of a democratic society. What this means is that a balancing exercise can be applied to UNDRIP rights where they interfere with other societal rights. States said the reason that they needed this was to protect state integrity or to stop the formation or splintering of nation states as a result of UNDRIP being used by Indigenous peoples to secede from the larger public body. But subsection 1 largely takes care of that. So it's clear that nation states wanted more because subsection 2 of Article 46 does do more there. However, those who say that the article serves to make UNDRIP meaningless or weakens it in some detrimental way forget that no right in society is absolute. That is, there's always a need to balance rights. And Article 46 even goes further with subsection 3 stating that the balancing process needs to be done in good faith and with fairness. So at the end of the day, Article 46 just says something that applies to all rights. That is, that even UNDRIP rights are not absolute and must be weighed against other societal rights, including the rights of other people. So from a legal point of view, this would have happened with or without Article 46, and it could be argued that the fact that Article 46 recognizes the need for this balance of rights strengthens UNDRIP by making it more clearly translatable into workable law. And translatable to law are words that I want to focus on for a moment, because we need to remember what UNDRIP is and what it isn't. As an international declaration, it is a type of international statement, not law. The United Nations uses declarations when it wants to say something about important matters where maximum compliance is expected, but not required. This means that the International Declaration isn't a treaty, a covenant, or a protocol, and you don't need to know the difference between all those types of legal instruments except to know that what it means legally is that the declaration is not enforceable. It is not binding, as we say at law. That means that you can't force states to comply with it. It merely informs states about what they should do, not what they must do. However, the Declaration is a statement by the entire United Nations on the expected minimum standards for Indigenous peoples. This means that it provides a floor for respecting Indigenous rights, not the ceiling, meaning countries can, of course, go above or take actions beyond the Declaration standards, but they shouldn't go below them lest they be at a minimum named and shamed. However, again, you notice that I said the words shouldn't, not that they can't. And the reason for that is, again, intentional, because the declaration is not a law. It's less. But in case that has you worried that maybe the declaration isn't so important and maybe this isn't an important use of our time to be looking at it so much, remember these two things. One, the declaration is not a statement from merely you or me, but from the world government. Or the General Assembly of the United Nations, the world's parliament, and that has power. And two, we're here to discuss more than just the International Declaration. We're also here to discuss the new federal Canadian law that makes the Declaration part of our domestic laws. And that is to say that the roots of the Declaration have since expanded from the international to the national stage, and that matters a great deal from a legal standpoint. So because of that, I get to skip over this slide and this discussion about, you know, how the law at international levels can be divided between binding or hard law and soft law. And I'm glad that I do, because this is a very confusing conversation, even for lawyers. More at the end of the day, whether hard or soft law, generally, international law works more through moral persuasion than it does through the direct use of force. This is because regardless of whether the international law is technically hard or soft law, the reality is that unlike domestic governments, the world government doesn't have a police force or a way to punish those who break its laws, at least not in the way that you and I usually think of laws being enforced through police, courts, judges, prisons, jails. Far more useful than talking about the reception or adoption of international law through customs or norms is talking about whether or not a country has passed its own law to make that international law the law in its country. And that's why Canada's United Nations Declaration Act is so important, because that's exactly what Canada did. So now let's talk about Canada's new law for bringing the United Nations Declaration home and why it is that that law matters so much. The short version of this slide is that Canada didn't sign the declaration right away, and then it changed its mind a lot before even endorsing it internationally or taking any steps to put it into domestic laws. It was hard to keep track of Canada's position about the declaration until very recently. As you know, Canada was one of the only countries who voted against it in 2007. Later in 2010, when Stephen Harper was prime minister, Canada said it supported it, but it was only aspirational and had no legal weight. Then, when the Liberals won election in 2016, they said they fully supported it and they would make sure that it was part of Canadian law, but not really, because despite being in power since 2016, only after the most recent 2019 election did the Liberals keep their promise to bring in legislation to make the declaration binding in Canada. Now, there's a lot to discuss in terms of background on this, but the short version is that Canada did finally bring an UNDRIP law forward, but not until after other jurisdictions, such as British Columbia, brought in their own UNDRIP implementation law in 2019. But when Canada did do it, it was done through Bill C-15, which became law a little over a year ago. And that was the result of limited co-drafting with First Nations and limited engagement, since it was created during the heights of COVID. But because of Canada's back and forth on supporting UNDRIP, there remain a lot of questions about how exactly the law is going to be implemented into Canada's laws. So let's begin by talking about Canada's Act for implementing UNDRIP. And I'll start by talking about what that act doesn't do. What the declaration law does not do is directly implement the international declaration. What I mean by that is it doesn't make the declaration's standards and the rights in the declaration instantly the law of Canada overnight. It doesn't, by proclamation, immediately overturn or declare any aspects of existing Canadian law that aren't compliant with the declaration to be invalid or null. Instead, it tells Canada's federal government that it needs to look at all of its laws to ensure that they are in harmony with the Declaration, and that means they have to go through a very thorough internal review process, a review process that needs to be done with the help of Indigenous peoples. And the Act has three core tools for making the Declaration the law in Canada. First is an action plan to implement the objectives of the Declaration without delay. Second, the Canadian government must take all steps necessary to ensure that Canadian laws are in harmony with the Declaration by working with Indigenous peoples and figuring out from them which laws need to be changed and how. And third, the Crown must give Parliament an update every year on how its work of bringing Canada's laws into alignment with the Declaration is progressing. It's important to note at this stage that this process only works for federal laws, not for territorial or provincial laws. So, for example, the Northwest Territories government would have to make and pass its own declaration law if it wanted to start a formal process of bringing all of its laws up to the declaration standards. We can see from this that Canada's approach under the declaration law will be to have their laws slowly changed over time, not right away. It's important, though, because we need to remember that Canada's law in backing the declaration this way shows support for these Indigenous rights to become a part of Canadian law, even if made subject to a gradual and incremental process. Even though this act could perhaps do more to get the declaration into Canadian law faster and harder, I think it's important to remember that before we criticize it too much, that the rights in the declaration might not have been put into Canadian law in any way other than slowly and piecemeal through international agreements if it was not for this law. So if we look now at some of the key challenges and considerations in implementing the declarations, what we see is that this partnered implementation process with Indigenous peoples presents both an opportunity and a risk. It is a chance to find and rank the Canadian laws that Indigenous peoples think need to be replaced or changed to meet UNDRIP standards, and that's a plus. However, considering the short time frame that's involved in getting this first action plan, it's concerning if Canada takes a pan-Indigenous approach to this process. So if they don't take into account the different voices, laws, and jurisdictions of Indigenous peoples in a proper way, we need to keep in mind that there are 644 different First Nation communities in Canada. That doesn't even include the Inuit and Métis in that number. So for the declaration to be put into action, everyone will have to do their part. And to do that properly, it's going to take time and resources. Another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, First Nations around the country won't all have the same priorities. For example, my clients in the Northwest Territories don't have the same priorities as those in British Columbia or Ontario, for instance. So my clients in, you know, British Columbia or Ontario or the southern regions of the country, you know, that use primarily a reserve system instead of modern treaties, often they want the Indian Act or acts that are linked to the Indian Act to be changed as soon as possible through the action plan. But the Indian Act is much less important in the North, as you know, where modern treaties are more common and where the promises in old peace and friendship treaties about making reservations were never kept. So when laws need to be changed, people in the North often have very different ideas about what should come first than people in the South. And so how the action plan making process navigates these issues will be extremely important. And this makes me think primarily to procedural observations for the action plan at this stage. So we really need to get a better sense of, you know, how Canada proposes to consult and collaborate with Indigenous peoples. Do they have to accept what Indigenous peoples suggest for the action plans? Who gets the last say in these instances? Those details have not been fleshed out at this point. And over the next year, Canada is going to ask people from all over the country what changes to key laws should be made first. And in less time than that, so, you know, 9 or 10 months from now, that process will be done and we will have our first action plan. So we obviously have very little time to be thinking about a list of laws that are important to us that need to be updated. But my first thoughts go further than just identifying the laws. I think for this work to move forward, not only is a lot more time and resources going to be needed, I mean, decolonizing Canadian laws to make room for Indigenous laws is a massive project. But ultimately, since that process will take decades, we need to not only focus on which specific pieces of Canadian legislation need to be changed at this stage to be brought up to UNDRIP standards, but also to lay out a structured process for ensuring that the action plan and future action plans are done in a way that is truly in partnership with Indigenous peoples, because that's one of the biggest promises that exists in Canada's UNDRIP implementation law is the partnership process. So the key takeaway for me is probably that the full alignment of Canada's laws with the Declaration's rights, it's generational work. You know, implementing it will be a process, not an event. It will be achieved over a long journey, not in leaps and bounds. So hence my use of the tortoise and hare here on these slides, because doing it right will take time. And, you know, that might miss the expectations of some who want to see transformative change right away. But if it's done right, it has the potential to change how Indigenous and non-Indigenous governments work together and ultimately how reconciliation itself unfolds overall. And that is a huge opportunity. So instead of thinking of this process as the end, I think that it's more productive to think of the UNDRIP law as the beginning of something big that will help Indigenous people's rights move forward. And this message of tamping down on initial expectations is one that seems to be shared on all sides of the aisle. So this quote is from the Canadian Department of Justice's website, and you'll see that, and you'll see that that quote is very similar to the one by former Assembly First Nations Chief Phil Fontaine. So basically, you know, they're both Indigenous governmental leaders. Canadian governmental leaders are both basically saying the same thing, that, you know, this is the beginning of a process, not the end. And so preparing everyone for the long road ahead we have of decolonizing Canadian law. The future path and the do-it-yourself approach to UNDRIP. This is the final section of this presentation and a critical piece. We need to remember that UNDRIP itself came from Indigenous peoples and their leadership, not from countries. And the same will apply when it comes to seeing through Canada's UNDRIP implementation law. FPIC, or Free, Prior, and Informed Consent, is of course an important aspect of the Declaration. It's not just one right in one part of the Declaration, but instead is found throughout the Declaration's rights. And while it's definitely the elephant or gorilla in the room whenever you talk about the Declaration, it's actually not that complicated. And a very straightforward explanation of this aspect of the Declaration is simply that it becomes a legal tool for returning to treaty making together in how Canada and Indigenous peoples work with one another. See, consent is far from new. It's in fact the way that Indigenous peoples and the Crown began their interactions and relationship with one another. It's also not rare at all today, as it's increasingly the norm in how First Nations and industry engage with one another on extractive resource projects all across the country. More, consent circumstances exist under both existing constitutional law and within the Declaration. But in neither case is consent categorical or absolute across the board. Instead, it's a spectrum analysis based on the right that's at risk and the impact that's involved. So then, one often asks, if consent doesn't always mean the final authority to say yes or no, how does UNDRIP provide so much more than the current Canadian law? And the answer is that FPIC does this because it makes the clear objective in getting together is always to obtain consent. It's never merely to consult or get input or feedback. And this is true even where actual consent being obtained at the end of the process itself is not required at the end of the day. And it still matters. And the reason that it matters is because the way you do something, how you begin it, has a fundamental impact on both what you end up determining and where it is that you end up. And if Indigenous peoples and the Canadian government begin from a position of true nation-to-nation relations, they are far more likely to see a fruitful and fair result at the end of the day. And this is part of the promise of UNDRIP, because operationalizing consent will be the implementation flashpoint on UNDRIP implementation issues going forward. And if I could select one key benchmark for progress, one thing where we could look and say, hey, here's an indicator that we're making real progress on the declaration's implementation, it would be around the issues of free, prior, and informed consent. It would be all about consent. And if we could just drop the FPIC language and just call it what it is, which is negotiation. Because it basically just means that the Crown needs to move away from consultation and move towards negotiation to seek the agreement of Indigenous peoples before they make a decision or take any action that has an impact upon Indigenous peoples' rights. And seeking permission of Indigenous peoples first, becoming the starting point, is again not that very far from where we began in our relationship with one another. So if we can get back to the point where that is what is being done and is required by government, then I think we will really be able to say that we've made progress, not just on implementing the declaration, but on also moving forward with meaningful reconciliation. Because seeking consent will include the room for shared decision-making and the shared space for both Indigenous and federal laws to operate at the same time. And this would be very similar to how federal and provincial governments interact with one another today, where they cooperate as distinct but separate orders of government, and they seek to negotiate with one another within the spheres of their power and jurisdiction as governing partners. And the best way for Indigenous peoples to push that forward is to make UNDRIP's standards and its consent-oriented processes mainstream. And you can do that by building them in to everything that the community government does. So wherever it can, however it can, whether through protocols, First Nation licenses, permits, Indigenous legal orders, even where self-asserted, all of these things help to promote and push forward the implementation of UNDRIP.
Okay, some final comments, Yulin, we'll start with you first.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been a great example of, you know, the separation that exists legally. Yeah, and this is what it's about in the sense of what Yidinji is doing here. Tribally, it hasn't changed. It's always been governing, and they've given the authority to certain persons to, you know, represent within a government structure, and all the other nations on this country that have been here for tens of thousands of years can do the same thing and, you know, experience what we're experiencing with the enormous international support and offers that keep coming in.
Yeah, thank you for that. Ganyara, some final comments about the foreign, the diplomacy stuff in that article, but also does UNDRIP reside inside of Australia or inside of Canada? Is that the mechanism, or what do you think about that too?
Well, look, they introduce international legislation or international norms into their domestic legislation, like what Canada has done. And I don't know if you can remember back not long ago, they had to relinquish control of Haida lands, you know, the lands of the Haida people over there, which is on the west coast of Canada.